The idea that Dave had that I had nothing to do with, really, for measuring a variation in ME over MP with molecules, it turns out that there's a way to get enhanced sensitivity to the shift that allows you to say something meaningful without doing too much work. But since this is a fundamental constants variation conference, and there's a couple other things that I've kind of worked on that are related to this, I thought I might take the time to also tell you about this idea that we're going to do in my group at UCLA on this 229 thorium nucleus. And then, since some people brought it up, I'll mention some work that we did on this OH spectroscopy for constraining the fine structure constant at the end of the talk. It'll just be a few slides, and mostly it's just a mechanism for me to ask questions to the radio astronomy people here. All right. So the first part of my talk will just be about Dave's idea, this idea of constraining variation of mu ME over MP. I don't think, just to give you an outline, I don't think I really have to motivate to you why we need to study it. But I will motivate to you why molecules are a good experimental test bed to study it. And the idea is basically sort of what Dima said, is that you have this lever arm towards the variation. So you don't have to be, you know, as precise as you have to be with an optical clock. And then I'll quickly tell you about the apparatus, because you may not be familiar with it, and then the results of a preliminary search. So the important people in this, and you'll notice that I'm not in here because I had nothing to do with it, is Jeremy Sage and Sunil Sanis, who were the grad students, and then there's theory support from Tom Bergman, Svetlana Kochkova, and Ida Tiefinger. All right. So I'm not going to bother to motivate to you why the constants might vary, and I'm not even going to bother to say why it might be more important to study mu. I mean, because we've all heard a few times how, from these grand unified theories, that mu actually may be changing quite a bit more strongly than alpha. But what I will say is, you know, these optical atomic clocks have constrained this pretty well. But, and maybe this is naive of me, but from my understanding of these experiments, you know, they're at the part 10 to the 17 level. They're probably going to get to the part 10 to the 18 level. But then there's some pretty serious systematics they're going to deal with. I mean, if you look at the history of these experiments, you know, the sensitivity is screaming down. But there's some pretty serious things to consider at the 10 to the 18 level. So it's important to think of other systems that we don't have to measure as accurately to constrain alpha, you know, at this level. And that's really the motivation here. All right. So, but before I get ahead of myself, I'm just going to remind you all of what a molecule is. You guys probably all know this, but maybe you haven't thought about it in this way. So what I've shown here are called the adiabatic molecular potentials for a cesium-2 molecule. So this is the potential that two cesium atoms feel if they get close to each other. Here's the internuclear distance, and here's the energy. So at long range, it's just some van der Waals 1/r6 interaction. At short range, you know, the electronic wave functions start to overlap, you get some covalent effects. And then if you keep going, there's some hard wall repulsion, right? And the same thing could happen if, say, one of the cesium atoms is in an excited state. Except there, it's usually a little bit longer range potential. Right? The scale of this, just to set your scale, is, you know, this is optical type energies, 300 terahertz, EV and a half or so. Now, these potentials support bound states. And those bound states are exactly the vibrational levels of the molecule. And these are actually this is actually the degree of freedom we're going to use. But the energy scale of those is on the order of 0.1 to 1 terahertz. Now, if you zoom in on one of these bound states, you see that it's actually split by another degree of freedom. And that's the end over end rotation of the molecule. Right, so, you know, with molecules, you have this extra, with just a diatom, you have this and you have this that you don't have with a regular atom. And that sort of, in a very vague sense, tells you the sort of importance of molecules. The sense that you have these sort of three energy terms in your energy that arise from these very different interactions, right? And so you have the transitions that depend on the different constants differently. And so by measuring, you know, some combination of rotational, vibrational, or rho vibrational electronic transitions, you can tease out the dependence on individual fundamental constants from a single system. So it's kind of the lever arm, if you will. All right. Yeah. So if you look at this molecular potential near the bounds or near the bottom of the well, it's very harmonic, right? And so in that case, what you expect is just that the vibrational energy levels just have some H bar omega splitting, right? Just harmonic oscillator. The frequency of the splitting is given, I mean, in sort of the spring analogy, by just square root k over m, or roughly the Rydberg times square root of mu, where mu is me over np, right? So you immediately see the point is that if you consider this level way up here at the top, there's an n enhancement in any change in its energy as you change mu. The way to see that is, you know, the energy of this level is just the vibrational number h omega, d over e is just n to mu over mu. You can sort of think of it as a pileup. This guy moves by some amount, pushes this guy up, but then he moves too. And so by the time you get up there, it's moved by n of those. All right. So that's nice in that you have this sort of enhancement to your shift. But what's even better is that if you have another electronic potential well that has a minimum, you hear a really nice situation arises. Now, you can get this well from something like a different spin configuration. And in the molecule I'll tell you about, which is cesium, you'll have a.
To the right. I think delta E is enhanced by the factor of n. I think you divide again by E.
Yeah, you got the mu here. Just go through it. But anyway, in the case of cesium 2, which we're working with, it's going to be the singlet and the triplet state. So, you know, you're adding two spin 1/2 atoms, you can either have a singlet or a triplet. And so if you zoom in, what you see is, you know, you have some level from the green potential, some level from the blue potential. If mu changes, the blue level is going to shift a lot, but the green level is not. So not only do you have this large absolute shift, you have a large relative shift. It's nice. I mean, it's not absolutely crucial, but it makes the experiment much easier because you're measuring the shift on, say, a 200 megahertz line.
I don't understand your question, which Michael Kozlov asked. It's still in the ratio, it's, there is no m.
There is no
delta E over E.
So if you just.
If E is single.
Yeah.
Ah, so it's not positional for
E zero. Yeah.
It's E zero, so it's not. It's
E,
not
E is not the whole.
Yeah.
Just one.
It's HME.
Yeah. Right. So in fact, we are looking at this small.
Delta E over HME, yes. Delta E over.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the shift on the energy. Right. But here's the truth of the matter is that molecular potentials aren't harmonic. Right. They're described by roughly something like a Morse potential, where, you know, at the bottom of the well it looks very harmonic, but in the near the top you get this pile up. Right. And so what happens is, because the density of states increases here, the shift that you expect to see goes down. Right. If you look at this, this is just solving this Morse potential with a 10% change in mu. Initially you see the sort of pile up of the shift that you expect, but then it starts to roll over and goes back down. You can sort of think of it as roughly the k of the spring is decreasing here, and so the sort of change in the frequency for the same change in mu decreases. So if you plot the sensitivity to a change in mu as a function of binding energy, what you see is this. So this is what you would expect for a harmonic oscillator, and this is what you get for the Morse potential. Initially it follows, at some point it starts to slow because of the and harmonicity of the potential, and then it has to go to zero at the dissociation level. All right. And so actually, I should back up and say this sort of real-life constraint is basically the thing you should consider when you're picking the system that you're going to measure with, because you want another potential that is going to come in somewhere where there will be levels in this regime, right? So that you're just not here. So the level that the molecule used in Dave's lab is cesium-2. I mean, the reasons for that are, one, convenience. We can produce it in the same system that we use for our quantum computation experiment, which works with rubidium-cesium molecules. And so it's actually easier than running our normal experiment. And the other is that cesium is actually quite heavy. So the vibrational splitting is small. And so if you're trying to find a degeneracy between two incommensurate levels, it helps if there's a lot more of these levels. All right. All right, and so here are the ground state molecular potentials for cesium-2. If you're not familiar with them, basically this is just like an S state, an atom. The singlet is just the spin. So you're adding two spin 1/2 particles so you can get a singlet or a triplet. The singlet is much more bound than the triplet just because of the symmetrization of the wave function. All right. And so here's the sort of energy sensitivity for binding energy of the cesium 2 molecule. In blue, it's for the X state. You see this large shift just like we expected. So, you know, at binding energy of 1,000 wave numbers, for a unit change in mu, you get something like 1,000 wave number shift. So it's pretty sensitive. And here's the sensitivity for the A state. Now, the fact that it's small is fine. I mean, we want to use it as an anchor. The one bad thing about it is you see that it ends here. That's because the bottom of the A state potential is right here. So the most we can do is something up here, which is, I think, turns out to be about 80% of this effect, which isn't that bad. In practice, the states that were measured were sort of in this level where it's at the 20 to 40%. All right, so that's the basic idea in a nutshell. I'll tell you a little bit about how we actually do the experiment in case you're not familiar with this. I think most of you are probably familiar with MOTS, which is the starting point of all this. We laser cool cesium atoms in a forced dark spot MOT for people that care. You can get densities of 10 to the 12 per cubic centimeter and temperatures, you know, 80 to 100 microkelvin pretty easily. And when you do that, actually what you see in your vacuum chamber, if you've never seen one, is a little floating ball of cold atoms just fluorescing. It's really kind of cool. Then we shine in a laser to photo-associate the atoms into molecules. So we start with cold atoms. We shine a laser to stick them together to make molecules. And I'll tell you how that works. If you imagine, all right, so here's this, again, this ground state structure of cesium, and then there's some complicated excited state structure that you don't really need to think about. You have two colliding cesium atoms. You could, you know, put in enough energy to excite one of them to the P state, right? And then the collision could happen with an S atom and a P atom. But if you detune a little bit, what you can actually do is excite the pair to a bound state of the excited molecule, right? And so now you have an electronically excited molecule. And what is that going to do? It's going to spontaneously emit a photon and decay, either back to free atoms or back to ground state molecules. And about 10 to 30% of the time, it decays actually back to a ground state molecule, right? And this is all given by the Frank Condon factors, you know, and even the free to bound transition. And so now we have molecules just by this process that are in the A state. The way the experiment would then work would be to drive a transition with, say, RF or microwave to a level of the X state here and just measure the transition frequency that way, and then you can constrain the. One thing I should say before I go on is how we actually detect these molecules. And that's through a so-called RMPI process. It stands for resonantly enhanced multiphoton ionization. The idea is we have some molecule here. We'd like to know, to be able to detect it state selectively. So we'd like to know that it's actually in, say, the V equals 37 level here. So we apply some resonant pulse that excites this molecule to an intermediate state. So the only way it can get there is if it, you know, the resonance condition is matched. And then we shine in much more energetic photons that take this intermediate state to an ion, and then we can detect the ion. It's a really sensitive means of detecting molecules. All right, just to give you a sense of scale, this is what one of these experiments roughly look like. The MOT sort of happens back here in this chamber. These are just the optics set up for getting the beams in. If you were able to remove the optic, you would see that the chamber looks something like this, and if you pop the top off of it, look inside. The laser beams sort of come in. We have this sort of floating MOT ball here in the middle. This is an ion detector, and these are just some other gadgets for the quantum computation experiment. So you collect the cesium atoms in a MOT and then apply the photo-association beam to make cesium-2 molecules. All right, so the sort of catch to this was the spectroscopy of these states wasn't known well enough to say, oh, I know that V equals 38 of this state and V equals 140 of the X state are going to be degenerate. So you had to go look for them. And so how do you do that? It's pretty hard, right? I mean, there's a reason that spectroscopy hasn't been done. It's complicated, and it's just hard to even get one of these sources. So the sort of clever thing that they did was what's called ion dip spectroscopy. Look, we know how to photo associate cesium atoms into cesium molecules. So it's going to, when that happens, we'll populate some spread of vibrational states that are usually pretty near the dissociation limit, right? But the information we want is about cesium molecules in this state. So you could do some Styrap process to transfer them down and then try to do the spectroscopy that way. But what you can do, it's quite clever, is you say, well, I'm just going to go ahead and detect these ions or these molecules. Whenever you set up the experiment, you have some now completely constant number of ions that you detect per shot, right? Because you have the same formation rate, the same decay rate, and the same detection efficiency. Now you add another laser that couples the state that you're photo-associating to some level, other level in the A state. And what happens? You stark shift these two levels. The PA, the photo-association rate, decreases, and you see a dip in the number of ions that you see. So it's a way of doing spectroscopy just by coupling this intermediate state to states that you care about. And so it's pretty powerful in the sense that you can find the level that gives you the most signal to noise, but then just tune this level around to map out the structure of the A state. All right. Yeah. And so just to set the scale again, this is that sensitivity. The bottom of the triplet well is here. So this is the only sort of possible region. The range that was studied is this range here, which is like 20 to 40% of the total effect. This range corresponds to if you could measure the transition frequency, say, from this level to the X state at the 10 millihertz level, which DEMA does, then you could get a delta mu over mu of 10 to the minus 15. It's really feasible, I think to do even 100 to 1,000 times better, and I'll tell you why. And so then you can really start to make really competitive constraints on mu. All right. So this is a little, it's complicated, and I don't want to go in the whole thing. Yes, sir.
So what are the lifetimes involved?
So these states, I mean, I don't know, they're many seconds. So you're going to be limited by the amount of time you can interrogate them.
Are you sure about this lifetime?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. From the transit, I mean, where's this triplet state can't decay it anywhere, really. I mean, just the vibrational lifetime, right? Now, and actually, even more, because now the potentials are more well known, and so are the Doppler moments.
Yeah. You get UG coupling, yeah?
The molecule. I mean, you can, but I still think you can get it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the limit is going to be, I think, how long you interrogate. And there's kind of a cool way of doing that I'll show you at the end of this part. Mm-hmm. All right, so how do you find these levels? Because that was the big problem, is that, well, these levels should exist, but we don't know where they're at. And this is the result of the ion dip spectroscopy, so just ignore this red trace, it's not really important. As you tune this probe laser, or this red laser, around where you expect the V equals 38 level should be, you see some dip. And so that indicates that you've hit a lump, right? Now, if you go another vibrational level down, so that you basically make this laser more blue, you should couple to the V equals 37 level. And more or less, the structure that you see, which, in a given vibrational level is due to rotational and hypersonic, should be roughly the same. I mean, they're basically just copies of each other separated by this large spacing. And so what you see when you get to V equals 37 is that instead of this one level, you now have two. And so what that indicates is exactly what you're talking about. You have this mixing between the X and the A state. And that happens because you have these really nearly degenerate levels of the two state. And so this coupling, I think, is like hyperfine or second order spin orbit, but don't hold me to that. So this is exactly what you want to find. You have two levels now that, in this case, are only 200 megahertz apart. But, one of them is going to be mostly X and one of them is going to be mostly A. The one that's mostly X is going to shift like it's, 100 or 1,000 wave numbers above the ground state, whereas around the bottom of the well, whereas the one that's mostly A is not going to shift very much at all. So this is exactly what they're looking for. All right. So there's a lot of data taken like this, and the bottom line, just to summarize, was that the experimentally identified one of these degeneracies, which was the vehicle's 138 of the singlet with the vehicle's 37 of the triplet. From that data, they were able to predict two other viable transitions. In this case, this was at 200 megahertz. Of the other two that were predicted but weren't actually experimented, they just didn't go look for them, one's at 9.8 gigahertz. So if you're familiar with the cesium fountain, this is kind of an interesting frequency. Because look, Jim Berquist and everybody, all these optical clock guys are going to put these cesium fountain guys out of business soon. And so they're going to need something to do with their cesium fountains. and here's what they can do with them. You collect your cesium lot, you know, you launch it up through, get a pi over 2 pulse, come back down, get your pi over 2 pulse. Well, now instead of doing that, you just photo associate on the way up. And so then what you're interrogating now are these, or is this level. And so then you can leverage all this. I mean, I don't know how the cues of these cavities, but I mean, you might even be able to drive this with the same cavity that they use, because cesium is 9.962. Yeah. So it's really sort of an exciting opportunity, is that if you have a cesium fountain, then you're looking for something to do with it. I think this is basically the apparatus is already developed and all the system, you know, a lot of the systematics are constrained, so it's pretty exciting. So via the estimates on this from Dave's calculations, is that in one day of integration with a cesium fountain like this on this line, you could get a sensitivity to change in mu of 10 to the minus 17. So you'd have to repeat that a year later, but it's pretty powerful. All right, so that's the end of this part. So if you have questions about all this, maybe it's best to do that now. Yes, sir.
In the triplets, so you don't know how to see them both.
Yeah? Right.
You need, but if you have a mixing,
that reduces the shift.
Yes.
It does. Yeah. And that's included. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's
right. I also add one comment.
Yes, sir.
Cesium is pretty relativistic system, so there are very sensitivity to alpha this transition, which is actually comparable to sensitivity to mu. So it requires more accurate calculation to find how sensitive this transition to alpha. Actually, you measure some linear combination operation mu and alpha, which may be not better.
Yeah.
Sensitivity to alpha is smaller by factor of u.
A factor of u, but it requires accurate calculation to find out.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of experimentalist comment is, I just want to see the frequency that changes. Yeah. But.
Any other questions about this part? So we can proceed.
Okay. All right. So the rest of this is even more speculative and pretty underdeveloped. So, yes, sir.
Up there, you've got the mixing. So you've got two levels which are mixing, and one of them is sensitive and one of them is not. But you don't know how close they are, how mixed they are.
You can calculate that.
The previous slide, I think, you can estimate that it's maybe 20-80% mixture the shape.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that I can do it, but the theorist.
But if it's 50%, you don't.
But you can calculate it. Yeah.
Right. Well, and the other thing is, I mean, it doesn't have to be that these states have to be mixed. Right, it's just that in doing this spectroscopy, those are the ones you see.
Sure.
So, I mean, I don't know. This is just sort of a measurement of a system that was available. I mean, as you know, Victor has shown us, there are lots of systems like this that basically have this idea. Yeah. So. All right. Well, I'll switch now to this idea of the thorium-229 nucleus. Like I said, this is all very preliminary. But so basically, most of what I'll tell you will just be by way of introduction, and hopefully, it'll motivate to you as well why this is important. Because as you start to see what the performance looks like, it's actually pretty exciting. Then I'll have like a slide or two on what we've done so far, which isn't much. So the people that are collaborating on this are Dave DeMille, Steve Lamrow, and Amar Bhutha, all from Yale, and Craig Faces, who's from. You actually may know from San Diego. All right. So as we heard yesterday in Eckert's talk, thorium-229 possesses this low-lying isomeric state that we now think is about 7.6 eV above the ground state. All right. So this frequency is low enough that you can think about directly exciting it with a laser. So this is different than what they're doing at PTB in the sense where they're talking to the electrons. Here what we want to do is directly excite the laser. The sort of interesting things to note are, you know, this is 10 to 10 millihertz type line width, so you can have quite large Qs. And so the ends up being sort of the impetus for a lot of the nice properties about it. All right. So as opposed to the way to think about it at PTB, we're thinking of it in terms of, let's excite this nucleus directly with light. And essentially, you start to think of something that you might call laser Mossbauer spectroscopy. If you're familiar with Mossbauer spectroscopy, it's basically exactly the same, except now our source is going to be a laser or some synchrotron beam or something that we can control. And so you start reading about Mossbauer spectroscopy if you don't know anything about it, like I did when I started thinking about this, and you notice that nuclei are relatively insensitive to their environment. In some sense, they're inside this bubble, you know, this electron cloud, and things look more or less the same to them, whether they're in a gas or in a solid or in a liquid. I mean, there are hyperfine couplings and things like that, but, you know, they're relatively insensitive environment, and that's manifested by the narrow lines that you see in Mossbauer spectroscopy. So, to electrons.
-10^-15, 10^-5. So when you say relatively
insensitive. All I'm trying to say right now is that compared to electrons, you dope an atom into a crystal, it goes into a band, yeah. Right?
An electron, we never think that if you put atom inside the crystal, you can use it as a star.
Right, exactly.
So yeah. That means that we have environment affects atoms in good standards much weaker than.
Right, exactly.
So what you mean still relatively? Do you think that when you put it into solid state, it would not depend on kind of crystal and the level of 10^-15?
I'll get to that actually. That's okay. Part of that. Yeah. But so originally I was thinking of like, oh, we can do this as a way to see the transition because we thought, well, you know, it's not going to broaden the transition and turn it into some band, so let's just dope it into a crystal that's transparent. Look, we know we can put a lot of them in there. I mean, you can put 10 to the 18 to 10 to the 20, depending on how big you make the crystal. So that helps us in terms of number looking for it. It's also simple in that we don't have to build a trap or anything. We just grow this crystal that we can take to wherever we want to measure it. And then we started thinking about it a little more carefully, sort of in the context of Mossbauer spectroscopy, and realize that, you know, not only will the line maybe not be broadened, it may actually still be quite narrow. And the basic idea is that you get the Lambdicke regime for free in a crystal, right? I mean, talk about trapping, you're trapped in a lattice, right? So you don't have any Doppler shift, there's no recoil. In terms of these shifts, Mossbauer spectroscopy has told us exactly what to expect, and I'll have a table that shows those shifts. And then again, we get this sort of high density. So started thinking at first a little tentatively that there might be some possibility of using this as an optical frequency standard.
Yeah. Not much doubt that if you put it into crystals, the line would be narrow. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if somebody else will try to do a similar standard, but with a different crystal. So whether it could be used as a kind of
right, so do the lattice, basically you're saying do the lattice parameters change if you grow two crystals.
Yeah, yeah. Indeed, we can use it as kind of hydrogen measure. We calibrate it against some
it's
one story. The other story, we measure it once, the transition, and say that in a class of crystal, the frequency is the same. So that's my question, whether we can use it.
Right, so the question is basically, if you want this to be a frequency standard, and I make two crystals, they better have the same frequency, right? And so things can't change from crystal to crystal. And so what are the effects? I mean, there are impurities which you have to control. But assuming you can control that, if you have a nice, you know, single crystal, those lattice spacings are the lattice spacings, right? And the spins are the spins.
Yeah, but again, at what level of impurity do you expect? Corrections. 10^-20, 10^-100.
Can you start with knowing the chemical shifts for NMR and sort of scale from that? Then it's not going to be very pretty.
Yeah. Well, so it depends on the crystal, but so I'll get to this in a minute. So to answer your question, I'm not 100% sure yet, but I think that it will be okay.
Yeah.
But I'll get to it a little more than that.
It's just a question about what you still don't speak about. You are going to try to detect emission line or absorption line. Because if you hope in some experiment to have emission line, to have a crystal, maybe it's an advantage. If you try to see absorption line, it may be a disadvantage, because if you make it more narrow, that's a problem.
Right, exactly.
So yeah. In this chart, yeah, I assume that you hope to see emission line for the first measure.
Right, so exactly. Right now, we're just trying to find the line, just like yeah. I heard it everybody
but you
else.
Hope to see emission line.
We're going to try to find an emission. The idea eventually, just this is getting ahead, yeah. is so June has these VUV cones. They can hit this wavelength. So the idea would be pick off a cone tooth, lock it to this, and now you have a cone locked to this thing. And then you could get serious about doing frequency metrology. Yeah. All right. So just sort of be dramatic and show you what this is sort of meaning in terms of paradigm shift from frequency standards. This is a picture of the NIST F1 clock. I mean, it's pretty complicated. And you could argue that the optical clocks are even more complicated. Basically, here's the resonator now. It's just a crystal that I can give you and you can take back to your lab. Well, that's a little bit up in the air right now. Right now, we're doping at the level of 1 part in 1,000 with cations. So you get densities. You can get densities from 10 to the 16 to 10 to the 20 with numbers depending on how big you make the crystal, effectively. Right?
7 parts per million.
I guess, what would that be, 100 parts per million? This is sort of where we're at right now. Or, yeah.
There's residual impurities that are about 1 part per million.
Right. Well, so it depends a lot on the crystal. I mean, so here's the other thing that I haven't said yet is, look, this is 165 nanometers. I don't know, how many times have you shot 165 nanometers through a crystal? Right? Not a lot, because it's hard to do. You have to find the right crystal. And so crystal selections has been the biggest thing so far. But I'll get to that second.
But that might change the impurities too, because
exactly.
Impurity ions can change.
Yeah, that was my point. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, so but before we get to that, I'll just remind you, you've heard this a little bit in the sense of how sensitive this transition is to alpha. So this is the result from this paper, which came out last year. Right now, I think there are 3 estimates out. This seems like the most complete to me, although I think Victor has maybe another one coming out. I thought I heard him say.
Keep my calculations in a little bit more sophisticated way. It's not so different.
Right, all right. But well, this number ends up being a factor of 100 lower, though. So.
But they completely miss the effect of change with deformation. They only can see the effect of the mean field.
All right, well, we can talk about it, because I have a lot of questions, because I by no means know almost anything about this. But at the bottom, at the basis, the basic level, this is the most, this is a more conservative estimate, so we'll just use it for now for making these estimates. You see that there's this huge so-called enhancement factor of 200,000 in front, so you expect for a change in alpha something like a few thousand enhancements for a change in the frequency. And it's even more so for the mass of the force. But in terms of what an experimentalist cares about, it's not delta mega over mega. It's what is the frequency shift that I'm going to measure? Because to some extent, measuring a 100 hertz shift on microwave, a 100 hertz shift on optical, I mean, it's harder, but in the end, it's not the most constraining thing. So for a part in 10 to the 17 change in alpha, that leads to a shift of this frequency via this model of about 3 kilohertz. In terms of the line width, that's shifting the frequency by a million line widths. So you see that there's this huge lever arm. So all we have to do, I mean, to measure a shift of 3 kilohertz, I mean, we only need to measure this to like 100 hertz, this transition.
Why consider alpha? If division before alpha is so small, it's certainly a measurement operation of what?
Well, just to give it the most safe, the most conservative estimate I can. Right? You know what I mean? Like, suppose for some reason these don't change and this change. Right? This would be the smallest shift.
Suppose order. We can suppose anything.
Right, exactly.
This
right.
Is,
this
then, it's better.
Then it's better, yeah.
No, no, it's better.
I think in such cases, of course, you always have to look at the largest enhancement.
Right. Of course, yes, you need
No.
Just wants to compare with other apples.
I'm saying
constraint, first of all, on the that is correct. You have set constraint on the mass of the strange part.
But I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about, like I said, all I care about is do I see this transition frequency change? I don't care about why it changed. This is the smallest it could, this is a very conservative estimate, right? But yeah, that is easy, right? I mean, well, if you can measure it at 165 nanometers, it's easy if it was in the optical for sure. All right, so that's the point, is that this is a huge leather arm, and for very small changes, we think we can have huge shifts. All right, so this is actually just kind of pasted out also what I wrote. This is a comparison of a clock based on this 229 thorium isotope to the cesium standard and the mercury aluminum and the strontium clock. All right. So this is the so-called quantum projection noise limit. You see that Michael was reported yesterday. These guys are at 210 to minus 17. The strontium clock, I think, right now is at 10 to minus 17, but they think they can get to 10 to minus 18. And this is sort of it's almost embarrassing. I don't even want to say this number out loud. this number. Again, this is the statistical prediction. Way before this level, there will be systematics. I mean, I don't believe that you're just going to hit this. But it sort of makes a very poignant reminder that, look, the difference here is, because you can have something like 10 to the 18 of these things, you don't have, like, statistical concerns are gone. It's completely systematic effects, right? And those, I mean, at some level, I mean, we've estimated those as best we can for mass spectral spectroscopy. And it looks like the biggest thing we have to worry about is this could be as much as 10 hertz, maybe a little more, due to just hyperfine interaction, dipole-dipole, because 229 has spin. So, I mean, don't take this number very seriously, but just use it to sort of see how powerful this actually can be. Right. In terms of alpha, if we could measure this transition to 1 hertz, which would be pretty easy if we had the VUV cone hooked up, then in 1 year we can constrain it to 4 to 10 to minus 9. Pretty significant advance. All right. So
four times 10 to minus 19 was with what frequency uncertainty?
Just the hertz. So you'd have to have a cone tooth to do this.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. All right. Yeah. But I mean, there's a lot to happen before this happens. all right. So just to give you a rough idea of where the experiments are at. We found one viable crystal so far, in the sense that, and the big things are VUV transmission and chemically accepting thorium. I've glossed over a lot of stuff here. We really want to dump it in as thorium 4+, because thorium 4+ is isoelectronic with radon. And so you have these nice closed shells. A lot of systematic effects from mass spectroscopy are reduced. So we have a few constraints on the crystal. We tried, so far, I guess we're batting 500. The first crystal didn't work. We couldn't dope thorium into it, even though it seems like we should have been able to. This crystal thorium dopes into it exactly like we expect. We're now working on characterizing it with NMR to get an idea of what we expect for the line widths, and also working on better VUV transmission material measurements. We got beam time at the advanced light source. Actually, for the next end of next month, we're going to take these crystals, which so far we've only done thorium 232 into there, and use it as what will hopefully be a null experiment. So hopefully we don't see any background light. It will be the sunday light. I'm just going to skip ahead.
Is the why? Is it ytterbium or yttrium?
Yttrium. Yeah. So in general, for fluoride crystals, it turns out if you want a higher transmission, you want the cation to be as light as possible. Right. So that's why lithium fluoride is better than, magnesium fluoride and things like that. All right, so the basic idea is that once we have this crystal with thorium 229, the very first thing we're going to do is take it to the ALS, the Advanced Light Sources, the synchrotron light source to Berkeley, has some tunable, pretty intense VUV light. It's wide bandwidth, but because we have so many scatterers in the crystal, it just doesn't matter. And just tune this around and look for fluorescence. That'll be sort of the first stab at it. Just to give you an idea of what we expect, here's the sort of count rate after only 1 second of illumination with the advanced light source. If the line width is really just 10 millihertz, we have something like, you know, many kilohertz count rates. If it's 10 microhertz, we're in the 10 hertz count rate. So we'll have to illuminate. The plan is to illuminate for a few seconds, collect fluorescence. You can scan the entire range in a couple hours. And so you turn this, finding this needle in the haystack into, you know, you're just going to set the haystack on fire and find the needle afterwards.
How broadband is
so it depends. The straight beam is a quarter EV. You can put it through a micrometer, but it doesn't change the filter flux. So what we'll do originally is once we just see the fluorescence, it's kind of funny to think about what the signal will look like. If the transition is really this long, as you're scanning along, you'll see the count rate go up, but it's not going to go down. And then if you turn and scan back, you'll see it go up again, right? Because it's on the time scale of the experiment, the lifetime of the state is, you know, basically infinite.
What are the backgrounds for this experiment?
Well, so that's, ask me that at the end of next month. There are problems with, like, if you create color centers in your crystal, there can be other fluorescence mechanisms. It seems that a lot of them can be quenched more quickly with elevated temperature. So one of the ideas is if that's a problem, then we'll heat this thing up, and hopefully those things will. So that would be another thing is that, you know, not only can we put a spectrometer here to disperse this fluorescence to find this line, but we can use the time signature. Like if this really is like a 5 hour lifetime, you know, you can look at this fluorescence for a while.
Okay, Alex. To start with.
Well, so we have done some VUV monochromator measurements of the transmission of the crystal before we go. That's true. But turns out they're really expensive. That these things are like $100,000. So ALS time is actually easier to get. and also it'll be just a good dry run for when we do it with the real fluorine. All right. So this is just to quickly summarize this. All right, this is a number I hope Jim doesn't kill me about. I mean, it is statistical. It's not real, but it looks like there could be as much as a million enhancement in precision over even the next generation optical clocks. It looks, again, like there's at least a factor of 1,000 improvement in sensitivity to variation in fundamental constants. So I don't know. It's a really promising system. And we're just going ahead. Optimistically, but there are a lot of things that the systematics in the lattice environment that we're still trying to figure out. So characterization. All right, so I will switch to the OH stuff, which is only like three slides, unless you guys have questions about this.
So maybe I missed the previous explanation. Can you give a very simple explanation why there's this big 10 to the 5 factor?
Yeah. So, I mean, well, I'll give you the experimental story. Think about an electronic transition. You have terms, you know, proportional to alpha. You change alpha by a factor of 1 part in 10 to the 17, right? That energy changes by 1 part in 10 to the 17, and that energy scale is about an EV for an electronic transition. For a nucleus, the same thing happens, except that energy scale is about an MeV. Right. That's the idea.
Yes, maybe it's even stronger. Coulomb energy of a nucleus is 1 GeV. Thorium, yep. 1 GeV. So it's enough to have tiny changes. Coulomb energy changes very significantly. So fraction of 10 to the 9 in comparison with atom. You understand? Yeah.
Yeah.
But even better for quantum mass. So I don't know. When you make some kind of a proposal, you should not refer to alpha. Quantum mass over lambda 3 is not a worse parameter. Okay. So you should. For proposal, you need to present a better limit, because if it's not as sensitive to alpha, so what? You in previous work, you don't consider alpha at all, you ignore it.
Yeah, that's true. No, I'm just trying to take the most, like, for the experimentalist, our point of view is what is the worst that could be, can we see that?
So, but when you can see the cesium, you don't consider the worst case, you consider the best case. But sensitivity of cesium ratio of sensitivity to alpha, ratio of sensitivity to some electron to proton mass and cesium is nearly one, and still ignore alpha.
Yeah,
but here you concentrate on alpha.
I think it's
good. Now he makes his point stronger.
That's
this point. You have to compare with alpha because that's a.
But anyway,
you haven't spoken about temperature in your crystal clock here. So do you assume to work at cryogenic temperature?
It depends. I mean, one of the important things is you actually want temperature stability across the sample. If you have a temperature gradient, from Mossgaard spectroscopy, there's this chemical shift. It's basically a contact interaction between the electronic wave function with the nucleus. So if you have a temperature gradient across the crystal, that it's something like, I think it's a hertz per millikelvin broadening is what I calculated. So if you have to, whatever temperature you're at, it's got to be stable. Now it may be that we actually want to be elevated in temperature if there are, to quench things like color centers and things like that faster if we see formation.
But you will also have a second order buffer.
Well, it's not that bad, though.
If you work at room temperature, you will have to deal with a total.
It's not so bad, though, right? It depends, actually. I mean, so if you take just sort of a harmonic oscillator model of this, I can't remember the number that I have, but it's something like 300 hertz per Kelvin shift or something like that. And that should be an overestimate because, you know, in some Debye model, there's going to be a cutoff for like the maximum phonon mode, right? So it's basically it's the same effect, at least you happen to have this temperature stability. I can show you the calculations I did. I mean, they may or may not be completely complete.
But I mean, beating cesium at that level will already require.
Right, temperature stability. It requires temperature stability. That's right. Yeah, exactly. That's true.
Cesium is required to find the line. Once you find the line, you can discuss it. There will be many, many options.
Right, well, so that's the other thing.
Find the line, which is the crucial one.
Right.
And after that, I believe that in one or other way, you will find how to make of this nuclear transition standard. So it's not a question to discuss now. Now,
I think it's a good question. yes.
You made a very interesting remark when you moved from the first experiment to the thorium. You said, well, actually, it doesn't matter whether you measure on the microwaves or the optical. It's just the absolute frequency.
Right.
But that is counter your
argument. It's not completely counter.
I feel it's a little
John Kerry-ish,
yes.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the comment that I maybe should have made is that delta omega over omega is maybe a good secondary characterization. Mm-hmm. Because, it is easier to measure.
Is it a relative frequency or is it easier to measure absolute frequency? Or doesn't, if that doesn't matter.
Well, in the case, I guess what I'm saying, in the case of like, in like the dysprosium experiment, delta omega over the line width is a much more important parameter, right? Because you have a broad transition. So the very first thing you should consider when you're looking mm-hmm. at a transition is what is the shift per line width. The second thing you consider is what's the absolute, then what's the relative shift. I mean, and the thing about making this ratio delta omega over omega is that it's this linear thing, mm-hmm. but the pain it takes you to measure this frequency in the optical or the RF, it's not linear with frequency, right? So I feel like if you have something that's going to shift to kilohertz with it for one part 10 to 17 changing something, you'll find a way to measure that for sure, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, if it's only shifting a millihertz on a very small line, this thing can be a misleading parameter. That's all.
Maybe you need delta omega per pain.
Yeah, the square root pain, probably. Yeah. All right, so I only have like 3 slides on this, and it's mostly just sort of podium for me to ask you guys questions. This is something I did, or we did a long time ago in June's group, where we measured the OH lambda doublet lines. The idea for the, well, I'll just give you now basically my 3 slides. I'll tell you the idea, which was roughly, I guess, first proposed in 2003 by Jeremy Darling, and then later by Shanglar and Conagar, as you can see, it's almost simultaneously. Then I'll tell you a little bit about the measurement we made, the measurement they made, and what that has to say about changing the constant. Sort of interesting thing in the it's a small world department is this is a LIMS advisor who made this the very best measurement of this before us back in 1972. So it's kind of cute. All right, so the idea again is you have some OH megamasers. you measure some frequency with a radio telescope. You can take LH, put it in the lab, measure the frequency. You compare and see if it's changed. All right. I mean, that's basically the idea. All right. So this is the OH ground state structure. It's a doublet pi three-house molecule. The bottom row vibrational level is V equals 0, J equals 30 half. J equals 3 halves, sorry. Yeah, J equals 15. Because lambda is equal to 1, there's orbital electron angular momentum. You get this splitting into this lambda doublet, which you're probably all familiar with. Because hydrogen has spin 1 half, you get a splitting of these into two hyperfine states, F equal 2 and F equal 1. And so people observe with radio telescope megamasers operating on this on these lines. They've seen all four lines, although I don't think they've found a source that has all four simultaneously. Is that correct? Just as a way of comment for people who might be interested in looking for these, the main lines, which are the F equal 2 to F equal 2 and the 1 to 1, they're not very sensitive to alpha. And the reason is the shift is common mode. You see that, you know, the part that would change for both of them is only alpha to the 0.4, whereas this is alpha to the 4 because it's hyperfine. So if alpha changes, because delta minus and delta plus are the same, these guys shift up almost the same, and so you don't get as much sensitivity. And it's sort of similarly true for the other constants. So what you really want to do is find a source that has the satellite lines in it. Right. But anyway, the sort of advantage, yes, sir.
And these powers. When it's alpha to
the they include the atomic unit. Just okay. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
So cancel one alpha square.
Okay, but then why there is point?
I haven't been through this in a long time.
Okay.
But okay. If you say it's otherwise, I could be.
So we always normalize on atomic unit because it cancels out in any range.
Okay, so
the
has extra alpha square. So I don't see why the difference here. There is alpha involved. The splitting.
Uh-huh.
The splitting is also dependent on alpha because if you go to non-relativistic limit, you need higher order of you need to go to the higher order of non-adiabatic terms. Right,
so it's
like
it's fully non-adiabatic.
Yeah. But to mix levels, you either have to go to the fourth order, depending. Then you have non-relativistic quantum numbers, lambda.
I think the point is that there is some hyperfine here that can be quite sensitive to alpha. And if you measure the right way, you can measure that. Maybe that's the
but for astrophysics, I think this argument doesn't work because this hyperfine structure is small compared to this transition frequency. And your line with in astrophysics is Doppler.
I'll get to that. So in the proposals, they pointed out three things. Well, actually two things, I guess. One is that because these megamasers are very localized sources and you have multiple lines coming from the same thing, you can worry less about redshift effects, right? I mean, you have this multiple lines coming from the same thing that can be very localized, so the Doppler shift just falls out. It's sensitive on alpha.
So the difference in
exactly.
velocity distribution
right.
is not valid.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, so whether or not you believe that.
This is the right statement, and it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the just lines are wide.
Yeah. Well, so here's the point, though. Well, I'll get to that in just a second. But I want to say one thing about this closure relationship, which is actually kind of cool. If you sum up the two mainline frequencies, it has the equal for some of the two satellite line frequencies. So if you find a source that has all four of them, at the end of the day, you have a check as to whether or not you messed up. Because
mm-hmm.
if your errors don't add up, such as the closure relationship, you can't. So it's this astrophysical measurement that you almost have a way of, you know, going out there and seeing. I mean, now, this is going to be true if there's some shift on this line still, though, because it's like a tautology. Like, so, I mean, I don't know astrophysics. at all, really, but I can imagine that maybe you can have Zeeman shifts and things like that if you have some magnetic fields. I don't know. I've never heard people talk about that. But in this case, that would still be true. So it's not 100%, but it is a sort of a bone-head check. Right. The problem that was claimed in these proposals was that the previous measurement, which was at the level of 100 hertz by Vermeulen, they were getting ready to be better than that with the astrophysical measurements. And so therefore, they needed laboratory measurements to keep from that being a limiting factor. So this is the point that I've had answered to me very strongly with both opinions, that there's no way they can ever measure a frequency at this level, and oh yeah, we can do it easily. And I don't know if there are any radio astronomers in the room who can comment on that.
Actually, I don't think there's a single radio astronomer.
All right.
Okay. I don't know what they're
going to take a charge
put towards you, but probably it sounds like an argument about whether you're talking about measuring a shift within the line width or measuring something, you know, where people guess that you can only measure something to an error which is about the size of your line width, which is incorrect. However, then if you're measuring things within the line width, you obviously have to worry about systematics, and they become harder and harder and harder to deal with. So, but these close relations are important for that. That's one of the main motivations.
Yeah. All right. So, maybe. Is the answer, I suppose. All right. So, this is where we came along. And what we did, actually, if you saw Lim's talk, he showed the work that Rick Bethel's doing in Amsterdam. And this is actually what Rick is building. It's pretty similar to this, except his is a little better in the sense that we have some pulse molecular beam, we slow it down so we can have a long interrogation time. So we just do normal Rabi spectroscopy here to measure this transition frequency. So what Rick is going to do is make a fountain so he can do just a, you know, pi over two Ramsey spectroscopy. But this works and allowed us to improve all four lines by at least an order of magnitude, and in some cases factor 0.5. Just if you've never seen one of these, I spent a large fraction of my life working on this. This is a star accelerator. It's basically a bunch of stages of rods like this with plus and minus high voltage. It makes a really high electric field. As a polar molecule flies in, it slows down. If you switch it off at the field at the right time, you can basically decelerate groups of molecules as they come to the end. And that just gives you a long interrogation time. So just to show you the sort of data you get, this light cross-hatching is the sort of previous best measurement, and the dark is what we got. In this case, you see, we just didn't take as many data points because we had started on the project and then sort of come to the conclusion that astronomers would never be able to do this good anyway, so why bother? And so we didn't stop. So we could always go back if we wanted to. The sort of bottom line is that we measured all four transitions eventually. And if the astronomers could do as good as what we did, it could be a 34th of a billion constraint. So there's a lot of room out there. You know, anybody who has a radio telescope who wants to go look for these things.
It is easy to go and estimate what astronomers think they're going to get.
Yeah.
You just need to look at the final error bar and Doppler up around what they propose and translate that into a frequency shift.
Well, so this is the thing, though. I have one more. This is my last slide. And then at that point, I'll come back to it and phrase that question back at you, basically. So as we saw from Misha, these are the limits that they have right now, 7, 10 to the minus 6, and 1, 10 to the minus 5. Over the last 7 giga years. This is before our measurement, so this is with the Vermeulen results, because at their level of accuracy, it didn't matter. Right? So it's a pretty strong constraint, actually. In 05-06, this guy, Nassim Kanakar, went to Green Bacon, I guess Arecibo, and took these data sets with the explicit aim of trying to do better than this 100 hertz for the line position. That was 2 to 3 years ago now, and when I talked to him, the claim is that actually for both of these guys, there was some terrestrial noise that sort of bogged it down. So I don't know if how the analysis is going, if they're still even working on it. But the claim from them is that the future here is bright because this frequency is in this cooled L-band. So L-band is, you know, just the designation of this frequency. And the cooled just means, I think, that you can use cryogenic amplifiers there so you don't have any real noise limits. They just need to find the right source and integrate for long enough, I think. And also the claim is that in the next 10 years, there's supposed to be some telescopes coming online that can get to this level in just a few hours. So if that's really true, I think that OH may sort of make a reemergence.
Yeah.
But I think that right now there need to be more searches, because so far nobody's ever found all four lines together, which would be, you could constrain all the constants with that. And also you could, you know, get the closure relationship.
Right.
Okay. All right, so I think that's all I have to say. Thanks.
I just want to bring this back to thorium, if I may, for a second. Just thinking naively, the scale of a generic scale of chemical shift for NMR is ppm. Or if you go to heavy nuclei like lead, mm-hmm. we're talking about 100 of ppm and really highly anisotropic and so on and so forth. Now, in your transition, it's an M1 transition, so sort of.
The highly anisotropic is it depends on the crystal, I think.
Yeah, if you have, okay, maybe if you put it in a cubic crystal.
Exactly. So you want a cubic center crystal, then the electric field gradient goes away as well. So that's really what you want.
Yeah, but that's, by the way, that's for 100 ppm for spin 1/2 lead. Okay, so when you go to 5/2, I don't know what's going to happen. But anyway, this is the scale of things. Now you might say there is no magnetic field and chemical shift is the screening of the external magnetic field. But it seems to me, you know, like if it was the 0 point estimate for a scale should be the same. You can also look at things like hyperfine anomalies that are at 10^-3 ppm.
Right, and so those levels, that line width of a few 10 hertz comes from those estimates. I can show you the numbers.
I can't gigahertz. I don't know.
I'll show you the numbers. It just works out that way. I've had this discussion several times. You can get the properties. Well, here's the caveat to all this, is that you don't know anything about this 3/2 state, right? So the shift is really what happens relative to these two things. So, I mean, we've based all this on basically just the shift that you expect to see on the 5/2 state. Assume that, you know, the 3/2 doesn't move. Probably there'll be lines that move common mode and make it better. But this is sort of not worst case scenario, but what we've taken is that. The other thing is that if it's a gigahertz, it doesn't matter because this line's so narrow, it's not a broadening, it's a shift, right? And so you can resolve these different things. So then it maybe becomes a flywheel oscillator and not a standard. Yeah. But I'd love to go through the numbers with you, actually, because it'd be great to have somebody else look.
Any other questions? So we are 30 minutes late for lunch.
Oh, sorry.
No problem.
No, it's overall at the top of the whole talk. So at 2 o'clock, please don't.